Here we go. Okay. Do I have one or, well, I've heard reports from some people that the blogs for next week weren't downloading through Blackboard. So I've created a PDF copy of each of them. So in the blog folder for the readings of next week, there used to be four things, now there's eight. Those are just duplicates. I put PDF copy. So if you can get the blog copy and just sort of read it online or print it, it might be a little cleaner. Because sometimes when you make a PDF of a blog, you know, the spacing is all sort of weird. But don't think I added four new readings. They're just, in case the website doesn't download for you, there's a PDF. We're doing something different today. So before I explain what we're doing, does anybody have any general logistical questions about the readings or the class or the blogs?
Mm-hmm. I have a question for you. Last class I wasn't here, and so I listened to the recording, and it mm-hmm. cut off early.
It did?
Mm-hmm. When you were talking about sickle cell.
Huh.
That's when it just shut off. It actually said it was longer, and then when it got to that point, it like became shorter, and then I went to listen to it again, I put it back at the beginning to see if
it shrank?
I refreshed it, and it had shrunk.
Okay. I will ask Robin. She's the master uploader. I feel
it's just like 15 minutes.
Yeah, I feel like I have become technologically cursed in the past couple of years, and I need to do some sort of exorcism. an offering to somebody. Okay, shortened recording from last week. Okay, other issues? Problems? Okay, in approaching this week, the topic of health, I mean, you could do a whole degree on health disparities. When I chose the readings, I chose three that I thought covered the gamut pretty well. The one from the Anthropological Reviews, I love the annual review, yeah, because it just sort of compiles a lot of the research for you and usually lays it out in relatively layperson's terms. The Kazawa and Sweet article on epigenetics, one of the few cases that I found where I didn't immediately cringe when I hear epidemiology. So while it was dense, I hope that you applied my strategy from last week, that if it gets too confusing, just sort of broaden your lens of your eyes and keep reading, and they eventually come around to explaining what they've just told you. They do it in, you know, the fancy language, and then they do it in normal human language. And then as a tie into next week, the Betancourt cultural competence and healthcare disparities, because that is, as we've said, you know, health disparities are one of the big drivers to the cultural competency movement. So it's broad, it's spreads out, it goes in a million different directions. So this is the 1 week of the semester. Those of you who are in the summer know what we're doing. We're doing a what's called a jigsaw exercise. There it is. So a jigsaw exercise accomplishes a few things. It allows you to get a lot of content into a shorter period of time. It's good to do in the beginning of a semester because it gets everybody talking to each other in small groups. And I've always said that when I was in school, I hated group exercises. This is not like get together and do a project. It's just sort of talk in a small group so that for those of you who have all these brilliant ideas but don't either get called on or don't feel confident enough to say them out loud, it gives you a chance to express yourself and debate on a smaller scale. And so I find that it fosters discussion later in the semester once everybody kind of knows each other. Jigsaws are done in two rounds. The first round, I have five groups, so we will count 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and everyone will then break up into their original groups. So we'll have, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. which hopefully you're probably going to have five people in each group, you know, like this. And then we'll spend 45 minutes to an hour with these guided questions, and you just focus on your one group. And everybody has to take notes, because in round two, the groups no longer matter. Each individual becomes a number again. So all the ones will converge in a new group. So each of these new groups in round two has one representative from each group. And then it's the job of each representative to go through and present round one's discussion to the round two group. And you do that so five times. And then I've given you a meta question to bring all of those groups together in the final part of the discussion. And I always say that I'm not going to talk, but I always get so excited about what the groups are talking about that I can't shut up. Well, I can't force myself to shut up, but I can't stop myself from participating. So I go from group to group to group, listening, throwing in my two cents, guiding a little bit. So, and that this usually, particularly for this topic, which is so dense, I think we are probably going to end up with the whole 2 hours. We'll start with a plan of 45 minutes for group one, because you need to leave more time for round two, just because there's more people talking. So when you're in your group ones, your job is to, and your group does not have to come to consensus. These are not sort of come to a consensus type questions. They're guides for thinking. So your job is to sort of record the group's collective thought, where it is contrasting and where it comes together, so that you can succinctly, within 5 minutes, present, or five, you know, 7 minutes, present your group's thought to round two. Does that make sense so far? It's kind of like it works itself out through acting. All right, so we're going to count everybody off, and then once you get your number, remember your number, and then we'll put the chairs in little circles around the room.
One.
One. Okay, perfect. So let's put group ones here, groups two here, groups three here, groups four here, and groups five in this
corner. Yeah, it's awesome.
No, you're with all the other
ones. There you go. Yeah. One for everybody. I'm going to walk around and make sure that read the questions, see if they make sense. Alright. Ted and everyone who is not here, I'm going to put you guys into. Let's see. What do I think would be most interesting to hear about? I'm going to put you in group three. Are you a three?
I'm group two.
Okay,
who are
you're over here.
Are you referring
I'm talking to Ted.
Oh.
Hi, Ted.
Are we three?
We are three.
Okay. So, hi, Ted.
Hi.
Do you guys have six? Who needs a sheet?
Yeah, thank you. Oh.
Did someone leave their phone? Or is it? Oh, okay. Over and then I'll start coming around making sure that they make sense.
Yeah, they did buy it.
You're going to see the shortest questions. What's going to be the juice of it is number is part three. Do you have any questions? Yeah. You can see some questions. I'll bring my slinky because I want visual aids.
We want to pick an article. Which one are we going to start with? The dresser?
That's probably the most dense. So.
Questions about your question. Oh, I love this question. This is a great group. You guys all look scared. You guys all look a little shell-shocked. Before you search through the documents, just abstractly say, based on what we know, how is race talked about? You know, the big ones are, well, it's socially constructed or it's genetic. So see if you can figure out in your own words what that means and then use the text for that sort of academic support and nuancing of what you're talking about. And I think it'll become very clear very soon that no matter that how you're defining race determines how you're going to look at health disparities. And then number three sort of asks you to tie all that together.
Great.
Okay, I will talk about
it later. Okay, so maybe we should start by briefly summarizing what the argument they made and then going from there.
Here's number two.
I definitely don't think I have all of this straight, but they were saying that.
So where do we start? Start our list, our own explanations of race
can lead to the mother having these stress hormones releasing, and then the biological, then the child
acquiring race by color and
threshold for the stress, and then at some point it affects the child's
geographical location
through epigenetics.
Is that how? I don't know.
And so the child ends up being predisposed.
I definitely think underneath that definition we should just put the word ethnicity there because that goes back and forth in a lot of the readings.
I think they're saying that's more of the socio-cultural context of race, then you can go by the geography,
and then inside that then you have constraints of SES status and other things like that.
What status did you send to
it? Socioeconomic status within the social construction of race.
Yeah.
I think we should focus, like you said, on the two, and then maybe work on one, and then work on the other, and then we can go through the articles and say, you know, which author is what, etc. So I think if we start with race as biological, then I think that's where ethnicity would fall under.
Right.
And we can put ethnicity/color there, because color was definitely something that defined race, you know,
in years prior.
You just said his air gap, which is sort of just like what exactly constitutes
we see that race is also on a biological level. Like, it's a drag that's predetermined that we can't choose it because sometimes it's just that we choose.
Right, this is, it's not a choice, it is predetermined. Yeah, it does.
It's a very abstract principle. Race isn't like a real concept, but we have.
Genes and different skin color.
Well, you see that biology.
The skin colors and different genes. I mean, the biological standard.
I
saw with Dressler's article that talks about when it talks about race, it says on the one hand the biological reality of race continues to be obvious to many, and on the other hand it is equally clear to many researchers that race is a culturally constructed entity, so it's just like the two sides of race.
It's hard to, I didn't realize that was
two perspectives.
So socially constructed, I think that gets more into like culture too. With the social construction of race, that race and culture now overlap instead of race and biology.
I think in the social construction sense, when we talk about the African Americans, for example, we may use the word black people or something. That means it is we, that our talk, our way of our expression, our way of talking, that segregate them with the Native Americans or with white Americans. So I think this is kind of socially constructed segregation. By color or by words? By words. By the language. Well, I was wondering whether we can divide the definition of race into physical or some social status. Like when it comes into the biological definition, we talk about the genes and the color that appears, so it's more of physical conditions of a group of people. Well, when we talk about the social constructions, we may talk about their social status, their cultures that they embed. So I'm not sure whether we can divide in this perspective.
So like the physical and the mental aspects are separate.
Right.
The US-born African American, the lowest outcomes.
define health disparities by NIH, what did they say? It was like the strength.
Yeah, I think so. That's what Nora is saying.
I guess for the major list in which the authors have defined the term race, I'm not sure how broad to go. I think I'm getting stuck on how broad to go with that, because the second one then kind of, the second question kind of molds into that a little bit, you know? So, like, I don't know if for this first question we should just be doing, like, the two that we talked about, biological and social, and then for the second we're talking about stuff like, when we're talking about definitions of influence in the study of health disparities, like, whether the biological part of that would be, like, just looking at morbidity and mortality rates based on, like, just biological factors as opposed to, like, socioeconomic status. So, I'm not sure, like, where our questions end. But I think, I mean, maybe the first question is just that idea of biology versus socioeconomic. I'm not sure if, like for this Dressler article where they have all these different models, alternatives for how you can look at it. Yeah, so I'm not sure if that is something that fits in maybe one of the later questions that we have, but not the first one.
I thought that those models like just defined the mortality. I was like, also mortality, like if you were in like lower socioeconomic status or if you're a certain race, like the African American.
That's like very shocking.
And like other things, but that was right.
Like, yeah.
Like something that were like, I mean, I guess that's how, for the second question, that how it applies to just food.
I don't think in the Dressler article they give us, like, I don't think there's one point in the article where there's a definition. I think what they're doing is they're presenting kind of both sides of the argument, and then what they're doing is taking those four models and telling us how each aspect is seen as you're looking at health disparities. So as far as, like, question one, I mean, we do need to answer these questions. I think for the Dressler article, we can simply share with the group that there was no explicit definition for race. I mean, unless I didn't read it correctly, but I didn't see an explicit.
I think it was just that section that you read.
Right. With like different perspectives.
Yeah.
So we can just say that Dressler presents two different sides.
Perspectives.
I think definitely reading the whole article as a whole, they lean much more towards the social construction of race. I mean, you can just get that from their own slant, but I don't think that they're, I don't think the point of this article was to put out for the world a definition of race and what race means, but it was more, if you believe this way, then you'll mostly follow this model and see it expressed in that way. Does that make sense?
Right.
I have to be honest, like, I skimmed this article last night. I didn't read it, like, word for word. So, I don't know if that's exactly right. And if anyone did read it word for word, correct me, because that was the gist that I took home from it.
The last, like, 44 and 45.
Yeah, so those are
Over
starting
with the
they give us any definitions?
Yeah, well, they say we assume that the term race has no universal biological referent that applies to any racial and cultural construct used by most societies that has only received biological definition from humans. Sorry, I can
drop. And in this circumstance,
so they're saying that race is more socially constructed than biological.
It's a cultural construct, is what they. So that's their definition. That's race is a cultural construct. So I think we could leave it just at that. Yeah. And then page 243.
And is it the structural constructist idea? They're from their perspective of the definition of race.
So I think we can move on to question number two, given that definition, and we could just take one article at a time if that works for everybody else.
Yeah.
So if we use that definition from Drexler, that race is a cultural construct used by members of a society to explain perceived biological differences among humans in specific ethnographic settings, then how does that relate to the study of health disparities? Well, when we're talking about health disparities, we're talking about just differences in health, right? I mean, disparity just means difference. Right, that's all it means. Right. So in this case, if we're talking about... But I guess the question is then, from like a healthcare provider standpoint, like how do you...
It got passed down from my parents to me.
Like, does race even exist then, from a health disparity standpoint?
And then so then if under social construction we have socioeconomic status,
right,
then it is technically
you're
saying that
you're the health disparity. Yeah, it's more like, though, how do you deliver, like, you know, when you talk about health disparities research, it's mostly like people target one population or another. So then how is, even as the provider or the researcher, do you actually target a population if everything is a cultural construct? Because it's no longer acceptable to be like, because you're all light-skinned, you're Caucasian people, you know, because you're darker-skinned, you're black people. Like, it's not biological, they're saying, and we're saying it's not biological, and it's not based on color, and it's not based on your parents. It's what you identify with, but it's also what I guess, say you are, right? Because it's culturally conscious.
Right. Yeah, right. This definition.
But I think what's important to remember with a cultural construction is it's not just how you identify, but it's how others
replace it.
And so I could be, you know, white, and I identify as white, but someone else might identify me differently. And I think that's what's important when you're talking about health disparities work, is because there could be a duality there. But what this question is asking is how does this influence the study of health disparities? So in this case, we're talking about people who study health disparities. And so if you're the researcher and you want to study something, is it okay that I say you're Asian, you're white, but you don't identify as Asian and you don't identify as white, then what are we really studying? Do you know what I mean? So I think if we go, you know, how does this influence the study of health disparities? It completely influences the study of health disparities because it's no longer acceptable to judge by skin color.
Right.
And it's no longer acceptable to just check a box given, you know, a list of five different races or ethnicities. Mm-hmm. That it has to be more, I guess, like, investigative. It has to be more...
guess you have to be more proactive.
Proactive in what ways?
Like, meaning that you would actually sit down with your participants?
Yeah, you can't, like, passively observe. You actually have to, like, go and be immersed in, like, an area or, like, a population.
Right.
And you, or can you just do, like, whatever, like, retrospective study to see, like, chart?
Unless you're collecting, like, how they identify and how you
Maybe we should just put as far as like sharing with the group that there is this duality and that you, like, you can't use assumptions anymore, I guess is the best way to put it.
Or stereotypes.
Yeah, and stereotypes. Stereotypes, yeah. And that there has to be a bit more like investigation and it has to be more personal than
individually different. So don't assume any.
Right, but what this definition is saying is that that's no longer okay, I guess, as a researcher to just say, because you're black, I should be worried about hypertension because that person might not identify as being black. Does that make sense?
And that would be really good. So that's probably like,
right. But it's up, even if as a white person, I don't have to identify with a white culture. Well, what that one article said, though, the other article with that point is that, you know, they said that foreign-born African-American women are not having low birth weight babies. So it has to do with the environment of who, right?
Which is also
plays
into our, like, whole geography thing.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so what's the summary for two?
You don't even notice the behavior because you just think everyone.
We just talked really about socially constructed, I guess, like how, well, here's how you identify and how others identify you all differently. So that the geography could exist that makes it difficult to study all the differences.
I think that assumption idea is really important for that second.
But then next
I'm just scanning that ending section.
Eventually you become important in that community as generations go on.
So I forgot to mention something about the fact that the experience where they have to
I think at the one part, they say that they call for a conceptual model of race and ethnicity to be developed. And I think that's the whole point of this, is that if we believe that race is culturally constructed or, you know, that it's just even socially constructed, then we need a new model of reference for what is race in order to move forward with, this, with even working in health disparities research, right? I feel like we've come up the hard way.
We have some, like,
Yes, it's so abstract, you cannot see it, you cannot...
Right. Well, that's what these articles are ultimately saying, it's so hard to define.
Right, right.
According to that article, though, did you read that they had definitely disparities? And they said that it was a difference in morbidity and mortality and access to health care among population groups defined by factors such as socioeconomic setting, gender, and ethnicity. And that's what that author, that's defined by NIE. Yeah, he defines health care as that in NIE. And so maybe we should, I mean, I don't this. I think
socioeconomic status or
society or poor public health officials, but I'm just kind of wondering on a special level, how would a particular physician be able to improve their care based on
I guess the definition kind of goes from biological side. You start bringing in gender and ethnicity, so it has, but now we're just trying to actually go through these articles and find exactly, like, you know, did they actually give us one definition of race? Did they give us one definition of disparities? And try and organize that way.
Yeah, there's everything from benign to pretty damning here in terms of how it's defined.
But I guess NIH is more favored toward the biological model.
Right.
Because it's very scientific. No. But I'm saying, an anthropological perspective, I think NIH is racially divided. What this article is trying to pull at, but it wants to be present almost like a review, so a non
What do you guys have so far in terms of definitions of race?
So we're kind of doing it article by article,
okay.
Like doing all three questions for each article. So we're kind of maybe finished the second question, professor? Did we finish the
second? Yeah.
So we talked about those two biological and social constructions and decided that Dressler was more skewed towards race as a cultural construction. He kind of presents both sides. And then for when we were looking at the definition, how the definition influenced the study of health disparities, we talked about how did we describe this? The assumptions that people may have, may project on races or about races, even if that person doesn't identify with.
One of the quotes that I starred on in the Dressler one was page 243, that the pattern obscures health researchers' responsibility to distinguish what they know about race as biological scientists and what they know about race as enculturated members of society. And so that's, there's something quite distinctive about this country that needs to be taken into account when you're defining race. So then, the question gets not only into sort of hegemony of the United States culture, but also sort of the hegemony of the United States within sort of Western biomedicine around the world. You know, there are genetic researchers doing racial studies around the globe who conceptualize race in quite distinct ways.
How can you conceptualize it any differently than what it is? I'm having a trouble.
What is it? Well, you could be black and not be an American, but you could be like Afro-Caribbean.
Most of the Caribbean individuals have been
Are you making that distinction just because of the color of my skin?
Yes. From what I understand,
okay. Then what would an albino African be? An albino African?
Generally, there are features that I think you could discern that I could still say you're of the African American. And the only question that I would have was if it was a biracial marriage that produced a child who could be very, very difficult to discern. That child, I can understand, and may choose to grow up choosing his background.
A couple things.
Sure, I mean, I'm open for
this.
I'm taking this as a very narrow.
Remind me about choice. That's the first thing. One of the foundations of biological anthropology and sort of genetics is that, so I think this is how the diagram looks. So if this is what we're going to call race A, black, and this is race B, white, there's more variation within group B in terms of skin coloration, physiological features, height, anything you could possibly think of. There's greater variation within that group. There's greater variation within this group.
B was African American?
Or whatever. So, but we're making a very narrow sort of, we're picking sort of the mean or the median or whatever. I don't know how exactly it's done. And that's how we're defining it. And if you look at it this way, you're like, oh, look at all that huge variation. They're completely different. But there's actually, I guess I said this wrong, didn't I? It should look like this.
But it's very diverse.
Where this is, these are blacks and these are whites. So the argument then comes around to is that humans don't handle variation well at all, because it makes it impossible to categorize. And humans need to categorize. That fundamental that we talked about last week starts with everybody, us versus them. That's how kids developmentally grow up. You don't sort of be in my mom or one person, and then it becomes, okay, well, we're separate people with a family and then others and all this sort of thing. So we don't deal with ambiguity well, coupled with the fact that, you know, so if you look at the particulars of U.S. history, you've got, here's a great example, which may blow the whole race exists biologically thing out the window. If you look at every census that has ever been taken in the United States, each one has defined race differently. And yeah, if you look in the, I don't know, when they first started, early 1900s, they actually had, you know, they had Negroid, quadroon, you know, which was, you know, 1/20th of black blood. It went on and on and on. There were like 7 different categories of black based on how much black blood you had. And if you look back historically, you only needed one drop of black blood to be black. That was how you perpetuated slavery. You know, because you want more black people when you're talking about black people being slaves. Native Americans, do you know, you need, what is it, 1/8? Or you need like 20%? In order to qualify under the U.S. government, under the racial category of Native American, I want to say you need 20% Native American blood. Why? Why not just one drop? Because we give benefits to Native Americans. We want less Native Americans because we have to pay more. So, coupled with the problem that from the minute we are born, we are born into a black and white world. So this is sort of, it takes, and this is sort of like other people, we ask the question, what do we do with people's beliefs that are completely irrational to us? Other people are asking that about us, because our black-white distinction strikes them as completely irrational. You know, in South America, my father-in-law, they call him Negrito, because he's just darker skinned. My husband, in high school, had experiences where he was called monkey and black, because he's slightly brown-ish. And in other circumstances, he was white. And you could have families that have the entire gradation, from blonde-eyed, blue-haired kids, like Santi, to my husband, you know, to Alejandro, to me. And to say, that's why I always mark other. Anytime anyone asks me what my race is, I just put other, because I'm like, I don't believe in this question. So we are enculturated. Our social construction is to think in terms of black and white and to make very particular distinctions. But I don't believe they hold up genetically. I don't believe they hold up physiologically either. It's just we're not given the data to learn that. We're not given that data in schools. We're given stereotypes and, you know, sitcoms. That's what we're given.
Choice.
Oh, right. So a young biracial kid. I'm not sure. I mean, look at Halle Berry. who was that singer that she played in the movie?
I don't know if it's actually
Yeah. Sort of, can you go in the front door? Can you go in the back door? It's less a matter of personal choice, but more a matter of how others are viewing us and what choices they're allowing us to exert. You know, why in certain circles is Obama our first biracial president? Why in others is your first black president? Halle Berry was the first African-American woman to win an Oscar. But, you know, she's another context describes herself as biracial. So the concept of race, I think, is probably as fluid as the variation within what we call groups.
We used to generalize them as black and white, and then we make that generalization and say black are like this and white are like this, and that's why we distance them. Mm-hmm. Put them into different distances.
What if I tell you this too? That at the turn of the century, if you were Jewish, if you looked like me and you were Jewish, you were considered black. I have an article for you. Yes. There's a great series of studies, you know, basically how Jews became white folks. Italian Americans, turn of the century, were black.
Here's the thing that
like
the color.
It's like the same reason that nobody knows that we interred Japanese Americans during World War II. We hide these facts about our history.
Yeah. So then when you're talking about health disparities research, and we got into this, if you actually, you know, if you buy into that race is a complete social construct, it's culturally constructed, however you want to play that term out, then it's really no longer acceptable as a health disparities researcher to use race as a definitive variable.
Not necessarily. It depends on how you define race.
But we're saying if you define race as a complete social construct, can you still, as a health disparities researcher, can you make up your own definition within that, or does race just no longer not exist?
What do you guys think?
I think it depends on your own personal point of view, because I can see that within even a socially constructed model, you could still put a definition on race and what you're going to claim race to be for your study, but you could also take the standpoint, like you said, like you just check other, you don't believe that is, you know, a possible variable.
But it still has an impact on my health and my health-seeking behaviors because of how I am treated by practicing physicians. The sort of historical ties between race and socioeconomic status, that I have a job with insurance and I have a little extra money if I need to pay for something extra. So that is the crux of this question, is how do you deal with it in an emic way as edict researchers?
Right. used. And I think that's what, in the Dressler article, they were saying, like, we need a new model of race if we're going to go forward with studying race as a health disparities issue, right? But they don't really give us any, like, they present those four models, but they don't give us an answer in the end. So it's still just kind of like this open for interpretation, I guess is what I'm saying. Issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like, they say we have psychological models psychological and sociocultural factors appear to be a problem.
Right. They give a guide.
They help you to sort of narrow the focus a little bit by how they make.
Thank you for being a good sport.
I'm sorry.
Thank you for being a good sport. I'm going to make it my goal to convince you by the end of the semester that race does not exist. Or races of social
constructs.
We all have bias.
No question. This isn't a question of bias.
My experience versus
other people. Whether they're racial or whether they're cultural or whether they're food or whatever. Music, etc. I'm wearing hearing aids because of Bruce Springsteen.
Last semester, it took me a whole semester to learn about how every identity does not exist, but it's all socially constructed.
But you're right, there needs to be a way to bring it back together, because otherwise you're left with just this abyss of floating around.
And I think the way that most health disparities researchers, and you can also correct me if I'm wrong, because this is a little bit of an assumption, is that they lay out a definition for their subjects to either identify with or not identify with, right? Isn't that how it's mostly done now? Like, it's more of like an if you're going to use race, then you have to like not interview, but almost your participants, so that way you're not making an assumption, but they're delivering what they believe themselves to.
Right, and then certain will get more specific, and they'll say, all right, well, what was the race of your grandfather? You know, what was his or her last name?
Right.
You know, and they'll sort of track it that way.
But is that the more acceptable approach now for health disparities research, that you can't look at a person anymore and just make an assumption that you actually have to interview them?
Right, yes, they usually self-indicate.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think we can move on to the next article, though.
Right.
Maybe work on numbers 1 and 2 again. I think that the
guys, we have 5 minutes left, and we'll take a little break and then reconvene.
That the Fuzawa article, the one about the premature births and the cardiovascular disease, all focused around Black people. I think that actually presents a pretty strong case for the biological model.
Yeah.
We're trying to define how the authors in the Fuzawa article define race.
So how does the biological definition influence the way health disparities?
I think we're still on question number 1 for Fuzawa. How do they define race?
Okay.
His was the one with the
that's why it was more biological.
Yeah.
Like, there's one
like chromosomes that I like.
And I think he kind of goes, he talks about birthdays, but he kind of tries to pull out some cultural constructions of birthdays, I guess. And he still argues that he comes, that there's a difference, even ruling out all these cultural factors. I don't know if there's a. Let me see the actual
Okay, now we're looking at the cruise.
On the last page of that article, on like page 11, so at the top right hand paragraph there, they kind of sum it up. The model presented here should not be understood as replacing genetic race with an essentialized concept of epigenetic race. Instead, it shows how social environments defined along the lines of constructed and socially imposed racial identities can drive developmental processes.